everyone, and welcome to the Screen Strong Families Podcast, bringing you the best solutions for parents who are serious about finally eliminating screen conflicts in their home. This is Melanie Hempe, and if you are one of our regular listeners, welcome back. And if you're a new friend, we're so glad you found us. You are no longer in the dark. You have finally found your people and answers to your screen questions that may just change your life. So today, what I wanted to do, since we have so many new people in our group, every now and then I like to do this, and I just want to explain just for a minute what Screen Strong is. We have had thousands of people join our social media, so I think it's time to do this again. Screen Strong is a very positive community that has decided to skip the problems with toxic screen use, because these toxic screens are hurting our kids and our family connections. So what are toxic screens for kids? We define toxic screens: social media, smartphones, the most popular crazy video games out there, unfortunately, and pornography. These are the screens that are causing unnatural high amounts of dopamine to be released in our kids' brains, and it is resulting in dependency and even addiction. These types of screen platforms are pulling our kids away from real life and from our families. And that may be why you're listening to this podcast today, because you're kind of frustrated, or maybe you're really frustrated and someone said, hey, jump over here and listen to these people, because we have some solutions for you. We are not screen free and we're not anti-tech. But we are all about separating out the type of screen use that is hurting our kids and their development, and it can be done. We know that with education, parents can guide their kids on a path to be successful in our culture when tech seems to saturate everything they do. We do not think that it is smart for your kid's smartphone and their video games to be their number one hobby in their lives. We believe that kids do not need smartphones. They don't need that internet in their pocket all the way through high school. They have laptops, and that is plenty for them to manage. We also believe that kids can skip the addictive video games, and that phones or games should not be their number one thing. They should have freedom instead to just be outside, be kids, and just have fun with their friends. We know that a simple voice text phone is all they need, and that's perfect starting even just around eighth or ninth grade. They don't even need that before then. But there are a lot of companies out there, and you can go on our website and see the ones that we recommend that are really good solutions for that taught text phone before then. And then through all the way through high school, they still don't need a smartphone. We believe that it is the parent's job to guard against pornography as well and take this job very seriously. The cumulative effects of porn damages our kids' brains. We do not think that it's a parent's job to over-control, helicopter, limit our kids' creativity, or even shelter our kids, but rather we believe it's the parent's job to protect, guide, and equip our kids and give them the freedom to be real kids during their childhood and get out of their screen jail. We call it screen jail over here. So welcome to our community and to this podcast. And if you are new, please tell your friends who are suffering like I did for so long with our oldest child with the screen overuse issues in their home. We are not here to judge. We are here to help, and we're here to provide a solution and a pathway, because so many people are talking about the problem and there really are not that many people giving you the answers. And so I just want to, before we start with our guests, give you a little story or a little word picture that I think everybody can relate to. Imagine that you're driving on the highway, and as we are, many of us are this time of year in the summer, driving all over the place. In fact, we were just on the highway a few weeks ago, and I kind of, this thing popped in my head, and I just thought, oh, I need to share this with you guys. So just imagine you're on the highway, or and your GPS says there's an accident ahead, and they give you an alternate route to avoid delays. This is what Screen Strong is. We are all about giving you an alternate route. Think of us as your GPS. We're a guide that has gone ahead of you to warn you so your trip will be easier. And when we were just recently last week on the highway, I'm sure whenever all of y'all are driving, this is what happens. You look across on the other side. Oh my goodness, there's a wreck. And we saw this huge wreck and it was like 3-car pileup. And I wanted so badly to warn the people that were just a few exits back to just exit and detour around this wreck. You've all had that feeling like if I could only tell them, just exit now so you're not going to be sitting there for 2 hours. We knew that wreck was going to delay the trip for so many people. So again, Screen Strong is like that GPS. We're warning you about what's ahead. We're not going to scare you. We're not going to make you fearful, although it is really scary and really fearful when you think about what can happen in that wreck. But we're going to warn you so that you can make good choices now and offer you a great, fun, and safe detour. Social media and video games are like a wreck for our kids. Hopefully not a fail wreck, but it is for some actually, but hopefully not for yours, but it is a wreck nonetheless. No teen is immune to the wrecks on the screen highway. You can put your seatbelt on and you should. They should have a seatbelt on and you can have conversations and you can do all the things that you need to do. But when you are allowing them on this highway, they will be in a wreck. It would be better if you could just avoid the wreck altogether until their brains were mature enough to see and predict ahead what was going to be happening so they could navigate it better. They are not mature. The pain that we are putting our kids through is so unnecessary and the risks are so great and the benefits are so small. So that is why today we are going to do what we do best as your guide, equipping you with the facts to help you on your journey and bring you the best of the best when it comes to education on screens, young kids, and teens. And you know, we love to bring medical professionals to you, and this is what we're doing today. Our guest has devoted years to studying the potential impact of screen time for children, including the first MRI-based studies in the preschool age group. So we want to welcome Dr. John Hutton as our guest. Welcome, Dr. Hutton.
Thank you, Melanie. It's a honor to be here and participate in this Screen Strong podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. And so as we get started, if you could give us a little background, you've got a lot to talk about in this area. Your background is huge, but can you give us a summary of your background as far as where you went to school and the work that you've been doing?
Yeah, so I'm a general pediatrician at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, primary care pediatrics. I did a research fellowship focused on academic pediatrics, which got me into MRI research, which we'll talk about later. I did my residency at Cincinnati Children's, went to med school at University of Cincinnati. Before that, was went to college and graduate school in North Carolina at Davidson and UNC Chapel Hill. I've lived in a bunch of different places, grew up in Kentucky, moved to Texas, and then now I'm Cincinnati.
Oh my goodness. Anyway. And our paths kind of like cross over here a good bit because we're in North Carolina. I know all about Davidson. And then we have some of our team members are in Dallas. I know you're going to be there. So it's just a small world. But thank you for coming on the show. So let's just start for a minute with what made you passionate about this topic.
Yeah, it's been a quite a journey on that as well. I mean, I grew up in Lexington, as I said. I was very much of a play in the dirt kid. I mean, every day I could possibly go outside, I did. And, you know, I lived in the suburbs. I thought it was a wilderness, but it was really just backyards and vacant lots and bicycles and whatever. And then when it was raining, my parents were big readers. And, I didn't think of myself as loving reading at the time, but when it was, the weather wasn't nice, I was in the house and my mom would read to me and we'd go to the library. And so, I mean, I think that between that with reading and outdoors, that was just my childhood. And then flash forward, I've got three daughters now. They're 30, 25, and 17. I think my concern about screen time came just raising them. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, I had an Atari. I went to the video arcade. I mean, I loved screens. I mean, I watched, my mom thought I watched too much TV, but it was really just prime time. You know, yeah. It was ended up being a couple hours, you know, on really not even much on weeknights, but it, you know, I mean, I wasn't at all averse to screens as a kid. I would have taken whatever I was given.
Yeah.
But raising my own kids, I just really, I think, wanted to sort of provide them with some of the similar experiences I'd had. I mean, I went outside with them. We turned over rocks. We do things that I thought were just part of a normal childhood. And in any case, in my medical training, I actually went on leave with my second daughter. When she was born, I was about halfway through residency, and I decided I wanted to stay home with her and help, just be a very hands-on dad, and was also interested in writing. And so I went on leave for what I thought would be a year, and ended up being 7 years, because what had happened that during that time is I ended up, my wife at the time and I stumbled into our neighborhood bookstore, which was going out of business, and we ended up taking it over and running a children's bookstore, starting when I was on leave, and that got me into the whole literacy space. And this is a big story, but in any case, big deep dive into reading with my own kids, and sort of just trying to be an unplugged parent. And right at the time when a lot of the technologies were really starting to accelerate, the thing that really I think got me was Baby Einstein. At the time, it was, and that's not to bash that particular product, but it was sort of coming online right at the time when, it was sort of drawing kids onto screens more, just video-based teaching for babies. And I don't know if you remember the product Your Baby Can Read.
Oh, yeah.
One. And it was sort of those kind of things that were getting pushed out to kids at younger and younger ages that were sort of taking them away from interacting with their parents in the real world and onto, at the time, videos, and then ended up being more just like internet-based stuff. And it was concerning to me, so.
Wanted to pause just for a second. For the young parents that are listening today, this is so critical right now, what you were just talking about, because I do remember Baby Einstein back when my kids were little, about the same ages as yours. But today it's YouTube personalities that are on. There are a lot of YouTube type programs supposedly designed for little kids teaching. I mean, I'm talking toddlers even. Yeah. So can you just speak to that just for a second? Because it's been a resurgence of this.
Yeah, it's younger and younger ages. Some of the particular things that got me was you'd have videos that were like, teach your baby about the sky or something, or teach your baby about trees or something. And I'm like, why not just go outside and look at the sky or look at a tree, and it's sort of like taking the whole sort of, because babies essentially, and this gets more into the brain development part, but really, brains are essentially analog processing devices. Babies develop most healthily when they're interacting with the real world using their senses. They're touching, they're tasting, they're smelling, they're seeing, and moving all that into the technology space, you sort of collapse it into two dimensions where it's all audio visual, and you're sort of depriving the child of the opportunity to touch a tree or to taste dirt or whatever. I don't know. I think taking dirt's good, but anyway,
I agree.
But in any case, these media are coming out younger and younger, and I think it creates the thing about Baby Einstein. I think that concerned me at the time was the marketing. It was stressful for parents because a lot of parents thought, well, this, Einstein's smart. I want my baby to be smart. Yes. I want my child to be able to develop all these skills, and it created this sort of unrealistic expectation that parents needed to teach their kids all this stuff younger and younger ages, that not just exploring the world, but just like almost a curriculum, using technology, and it sort of undermined their sense of confidence in their ability as parents. Well, I can teach my child all this stuff by just taking him outside or taking him or sitting down and reading with them or interacting with them, playing with toys. And so it created this sort of anxiety among parents that made them think, well, I guess I need to have my child watch this or watch educational television or watch these YouTube videos, whatever, because they're learning something.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of got me is sort of that idea that parents were being convinced by these different media companies that they weren't good enough as parents, that the kids needed to have all this multimedia content to learn all this stuff that really wasn't realistic, and none of it worked.
No, and it doesn't work. And that's what I want to talk about. But I love what you just said that I love that you said it, but it's really sad that it just really decreased their confidence in, their own ability to parent. I think this is where parents get trapped today. They don't realize that taking your child to the grocery store without a screen and talking to them and having all those conversations and all that, even from baby talk all the way to toddler talk to, you know, talking when they're 3 or 4 years old, that's going to do way more. It's going to be way better for their brain development than if they're staring at a screen trying to do the same thing. Can you speak to that for a second? What is the difference in a child's brain when they're watching a screen with a gal on there singing a song about the ABCs versus when they are, you know, out in the real world with mom singing that same song to them and maybe showing them an apple that starts with an A? Why can't it work in their brain? What's happening in their brain?
It's a complicated question, but I think essentially it's sort of, if you imagine inputs into the brain, sort of like, what are the different channels that stimulus is coming into the child's brain, and no matter what they're doing. And if it's watching a video, they're getting audio and they're getting video, and that's pretty much it. You know, they're processing lots of fast moving video content. Their visual center in their brain is hyper engaged. And we've done some studies looking at this around books and reading, which we can get into later, and then they're hearing stuff, but for the most part, they're watching. They're just kind of tracking what's going on the screen. When they're interacting with and there's not a lot of pauses. It just kind of keeps going. When they're with their parents at the grocery store, they're getting they're getting audio and visual, but they're getting touch. They're maybe holding their parents' hand. They're getting a sense of feeling, that sort of limbic system, emotional sort of fix, that sense of being loved, that sense of, because that's another thing that humans are hardwired to really depend on, and what helps children develop most healthily is that sense that they're loved and that connection mm-hmm. with another human. And you see that in language development studies, you see that in just mental health studies. I mean, just when kids are interacting with a caregiver who cares about them, that sort of, I think it really just amps things up in their brain where they're really paying more attention and stuff really takes hold much more strongly. Yeah. So I think you're just getting more inputs into the system that are not just about audiovisual. They're about emotion and the other senses, getting those senses involved. And it's open-ended, where you have the opportunity for questions, you have the opportunity for unexpected things to happen that the child kind of adapts to. You know, if you're looking at the tomatoes and then all of a sudden, you know, the child looks over and sees some apples, you know, it's like, oh, well, let's look over and look at this right now. It's just, it's a more open-ended process as opposed to like a video just kind of coming at you, you know, just.
Yeah, I love that. I love the way you describe that and that it's self-directed. That is so important for parents to be reminded of that, because I noticed when, you know, with my oldest of our four kids, you know, when he was on his video games all the time and on a screen all the time, that screen was directing him. He had, you know, he thought he kind of was doing things, but that's not really what's happening at all. The screen is calling all the shots.
It is. And I think a lot of this, you know, in terms of the overall sort of brain message here, kind of collapses into sort of two main concepts. You know, it's sort of like what is the human brain? I mean, the human brain essentially is an analog organ. I mean, it's made of cells. It's not digital. It's evolved over millennia to process, to be good at two things. You know, like one is processing senses, like being able to interact with the environment, again, touch, taste, smell, vision, hearing, all these senses to take those inputs and make sense of them. And then the second thing is to interact with other people, is to be humans are social animals, you know, mm-hmm. to be able to communicate with others who care about them, to be able to manage risk, to be able to perceive nonverbal communication, to work together, to cooperate. So all these things are really real world things. Mm-hmm. And I think technology is essentially a simulation. It's sort of like taking real life and trying to make it as realistic as possible. And it's getting better in a kind of a creepy way. I mean, it's getting into more like with a lot of AI and a lot of virtual reality and stuff. You know, we're trying to take the real world and fit it into this technological box.
Yeah.
But essentially it's a simulation, and it's probably not optimized for what kids need as they develop, just based on evolution, just based on how the human brain evolved to develop. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say technology is like radiation and it's going to poison their brains or whatever. I mean, there are some harmful effects for sure, but it's probably just not optimized to what kids need to develop.
It is, like you said, it's a simulation. It's not the real thing. And why are we so drawn to it? It's because of the persuasive design elements in it. It is so hard to stay away from it. And it's so hard for us as adults. And our goals over here at Screen Strong is to teach parents that this is not the best pathway for your kids. Because what happens when they become so immersed in that simulation, you know, then they crave the simulation and not the real thing. And the real thing is nature. It's outside. It's face to face. It's touching with, you know, another human being. And like you said, there's such a strong desire for humans to belong and be in a community. And anyway, that's what I'm hearing you say. And it just parallels exactly where we are over here at Screen Strong.
Yeah. One area where it shows up in spades, I think, is social media, where, you know, you'll hear a lot, well, you know, social media, and social media can be helpful for some kids, you know, no doubt. I mean, kids that are isolated, kids that have medical complexity, kids that mm-hmm. need sort of assistance with how to communicate with others, technology can be very helpful. It's not one size fits all. However, and I see this with my own daughter, like, how often do you see these sort of conversations through social media? You know, where you see a picture of a really happy teenager, everything looks perfect, the text interaction is all just wonderful, but what's going on behind the scenes is very different. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see these sort of interactions where kids are fighting through texting, and then they're getting this big to-do, and then they meet in person and everything's fine. You know, it's sort of like stuff gets lost in translation in a lot of the social media interactions, whether it's that sort of FOMO sort of body image kind of stuff, or it's, you know, the lack of nonverbal cues where you can't really see what the other person's thinking. And I think that's where a lot of the social problems happen. Mm-hmm. It's the simulation of this human interaction is not right. And you get these kids just get all worked up and they get anxious and suicidal. And, you know, and it's a lot of it's because they're bypassing that sort of human thing of just really optimized to interact in the real world in person, you know, where you can kind of see what the other person's doing and work together and talk about stuff and work things out.
Human interaction is so grounding, you know, when you're in person together, you see what you see, you get what you get, you interpret it the best way because it's in front of you.
And it's ironic because now we're doing this through technology, our podcast, but
right. Oh yeah. Technology is great for this kind of stuff, but we have to realize it's food's good too, but not all food is good for you. You know, it's just the same thing. We can't pretend like we can eat a dozen donuts every night for dinner. And my audience loves it when I bring up donuts because that's my favorite thing to eat.
Yeah.
But I can't have donuts every day for dinner. And if I keep them on the counter, guess what? They're going to be gone by the next day. So
yeah,
it's the access.
Yeah, totally. And I think another thing on this that's, you know, backing up to what we're saying about kids is remembering that we're talking about children is one of the things. So when I was in my training and when I got into screen time, I hadn't done any research yet, but I was more in the advocacy space. I did a project as a resident called Baby Unplugged, which was essentially making, like, it was sort of a response to Baby Einstein. It was a children's book that was sort of, it wasn't bashing technology, but it was called Yard. And it was about, like, you know, just encouraging, talking about how great is it to go out in the yard. And it was a book that was, you know, that I was thinking would compete with the Baby Einstein books. But anyway, but the tagline for Baby Unplugged is screen free until 3. You know, it was sort of like challenging parents to, like, keep your child away from technology until they're 3. The reason being that they haven't really figured out how the real world works yet. And I think that's one of the really important things about kids is, like, adults have their own problems with technology. You know, we're of a generation probably, and I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm in my 50s. Mm-hmm. Where we kind of at least grew up where we kind of had to figure out how the real world works because there wasn't any other alternative.
Right.
And,
right.
And now with kids getting on technology younger and younger, it's sort of it raises that question that, you know, are if kids aren't really learning social interactions and, you know, going outside and experiencing the real world in a really immersive, focused way, will they struggle later because they just haven't, they never learned that stuff. And, mm-hmm. and those parts of their brains didn't fully develop. And technology is just being pushed out to kids younger and younger, where it kind of gets in the way of that sort of real world developmental trajectory. And that's why I really think that, you know, keeping technology away from kids went during those periods where they're just learning the basics of, you know, for babies, it's sort of just multisensory, you know, what things look like and feel like and taste like. For adolescents, it's more that sense of self and interaction with other peers and where do I fit in the world? Just allowing them to kind of spend that time learning how the real world works. And then there's plenty of time for technology later. And then maybe they'll use it more in a more healthy way once they've got that grounding in sort of the real world.
And figured out the real world first. Yeah. That's what we're all about. Like we said, and like I said in the beginning, where it's not like it's all bad, but there's a timing for it and they need to skip it during these adolescent years. And I think parents are so worried, like they were when they were back giving their babies baby Einstein, because they want their babies to be Einstein and they want them to be smarter than all the other babies out there. And what we know now is that experiment really didn't work at all. And those babies would have been better off if they had been in the backyard playing in the mud, right? And so I love what you just said about being outside for younger kids and being with friends for teens. You know, being with friends through adolescence is sort of like, it makes me think of friends and spending time with friends and peers is like being outside for them. That's, you know, it's outside for young kids and it's being with your buddies for teenagers. And screens do nothing but just simulate that environment. So why wouldn't we give them the real thing? They need the real thing's always better with this kind of developmental stages that kids are going through. It's always better. So is it all bad? No, it's not all bad, but time, if you look hour for hour and minute for minute, time is going to be much better spent in the real thing when you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think it's overwhelming. I mean, I was just thinking about, I was reflecting on my daughters and, you know, kids, like when kids go through puberty, for example, I mean, they're going through all kinds of changes in their body. They're getting anxious about, you know, am I pretty, are my muscles big or whatever.
And
you put them in a group with like maybe four or five other kids or 20 other kids, you know, at their school, and they're kind of, you know, interacting with each other and checking each other out and talking and everything, and there's different personalities, and certainly a lot of kids struggle socially with a small group too. However, I mean, that's hard enough. But then put them on Snapchat and all of a sudden they have to navigate 1,000 kids that are snapping them all day, you know, and it's just, and all of a sudden I'm not like comparing myself to everyone in my class, but I'm comparing myself to everyone in the country.
Wow.
You know, and that's just kind of, it can be overwhelming. And again, like some kids go through it and they're not predisposed to being anxious, whatever, and they just sail through it, no problem. But a lot of kids will be paralyzed.
Yeah.
And my daughter was more of that way. I mean, just completely like, am I good enough? Am I pretty? And stuff that we would have never had to think about because we weren't, you know, out there at every, you know, and it's not just, and it follows them around too. It's not just when they go to school, it's like, it's on their phone at night and just in the car with them. And they're constantly having to compare themselves to everyone else. And that's going to take a toll on their, that's going to wire their brain in whatever way that they're thinking. You know, if they're feeling anxious, it's going to make them more anxious if they're, anyway.
It'll just make it worse. Well, talk a minute, if you can, about just, the issue around body image and anorexia. You know, in our community, anorexia, one of the doctors told me, is up 30% this year in a community here. And I'm like, whoa. And I think you're hitting it right on the head. And, you know, we love to hit things on the head here at Screen Strong on these podcasts. So let's just talk about that a minute. Just from your perspective, I know you've had some personal experience with that, with your kids. Give us a little more insight there on what that looks like and why it's happening. Why are they so drawn into the body image stuff, and how can that really hurt them? Because I don't think it helps. I don't think there's anything helpful about comparing your body.
I think there are, there certainly are campaigns on Facebook, Instagram, whatever, that are constructed to convey a positive body image, you know, be more accepting, but those are the minority. There's just, you have like 2% of the media that kids are seeing are sort of, you know, healthy body image, accept yourself and everything. And then there's like 98% influencers and just, you know, everything's perfect and photoshopped and whatever. And kids are like, I can't measure up. But anyway, I think a lot of this stuff, whether it's eating disorders or ADHD or so many things, the media isn't necessarily the cause, but it's an accelerant. It's sort of like putting gas on the fire. And like not all kids are predisposed to an eating disorder, for example, but it's probably so many things are on a spectrum, you know, like where child A has, you know, 5% chance to develop an eating disorder just because they're just not predisposed. Their genetics are different. Their brain wiring is different. They're just not super, that's just not where their head is. But then your child B is like maybe 60%, but then you feed them a constant diet of Instagram posts about, you know, the perfect abs or the perfect, hairstyle or whatever. And it shifts them along there and pushes them down more towards 80, 90. Mm. And so I think it's probably taking kids who are sort of in the middle, and shifting them more towards a higher risk situation, just because, you know, all kids have a predisposition to a bunch of stuff. And I think media, this is sort of a little bit in the weeds, but there's probably what we call phenotypes, which are like, different predispositions kids have towards different types of mental health issues around technology. And you'll have sort of the anxious kids, you know, where if they're on a lot of social media, that might make them more anxious. Kids that are risk takers, you know, who are going to be in there looking up, you know, porn and drinking and whatever, and it's going to push them along to be more risk-taking. Mm-hmm. Kids that are more depressive, kids that are more inattentive, you know, that have a really hard time focusing at school, and then you feed them all this sort of quickly shifting, you know, technology, and it's going to make them more inattentive. Mm-hmm. So you get these, the take home message for all that is sort of know your kids, but and that's hard for parents, but I think the rise in a lot of these mental health concerns, you know, with the ultimate being suicide, it's just that, you know, we've got a whole bunch of kids that are predisposed to these different things, and they're in this crucible where they're being fed this diet of, of content that probably makes them more, it's just amplifying whatever those sort of predisposing traits are. Not dissimilar from probably, tobacco in a way, where you get, you know, a lot of people will smoke their whole life and never get cancer, but people with the wrong genetics, if they smoke and they get cancer, I think that's maybe where we are headed towards a lot of this, and realizing that, like, that a lot of the content that kids are seeing is sort of unroofing these traits that they have, that, you know, towards whether it's eating disorders or suicidality, that may not have had if they'd had a more grounded experience when they were adolescents.
Yeah. So it's really not making it any better. It's actually sort of a gamble, right? It's like a slot machine. Like, you don't know, because no parent knows all the ins and outs of what their kids' weaknesses are. We know some of them, and, you know, you could predict with some kids. I have parents tell me, well, you know, I have three kids, and one of them especially is really struggling. And on a side note, it does feel like one in three are the ones that are really struggling, either with a video game or with social media, or they, fall into this eating disorder or the self-harm trap. And why would we do that? We don't do that with other areas in our kids' lives. We, for example, you said smoking, but also that's a great example. But also when we put them in car seats, when they're babies, we don't just say, well, there's a chance that I might not get in a wreck today, so I'm just not going to bother to put them in a car seat. You know, there's no other thing in our culture that we are just so flippant about. You know, if there's one little chance that my child may have some sort of allergic reaction if they eat a peanut, then I'm going to be sure that everywhere they go, there are no peanuts, right?
Yeah.
But with the digital world, we have to educate people, let them know that there are a lot of risks. And even the Surgeon General's, report that's coming out, there's ample evidence. There's a lot of risk. So why are we not seeing that in our culture? I do think that there are early adopters, and I think a lot of times it is the actual tech companies and it is the physicians like you. Like, you know, because you went to school and you learned all this stuff. I know because I also went to school to learn a lot of it and I've done a lot of research, but the average mom and dad out there, they don't know. And of course, that's what we're trying to do at Screen Strong. We're trying to say, hey, this is the science and we're going to break it down so you can understand this and apply it to your life. But I mean, there really are no other areas as a pediatrician that you would tell your patient, oh yeah, there's a huge risk here, but go ahead and do it and see what happens.
Exactly. I mean, it's a lot of that goes back to that baby Einstein thing that we talked about earlier. It's just, I think a lot of parents like are really anxious. They don't want their child to miss out. They don't want their child to, they see all this stuff out there, whether when they're young, like, quote, educational television. They want to make sure their kids, are presented with all the stuff. They think that they need it. I mean, the clinic where I work is a more underserved population and a lot of lower educational backgrounds. And, but the parents want the best for their kids. And they're like, I'll ask them, and this could be little babies, 6 month olds, is your child watching any TV? And they'll almost say it proudly, like, oh yeah, I've got them on there and they're watching that educational TV. And, I got them, they're watching these YouTube videos that are helping them learn their shapes and everything. And so a lot of it's marketing and starting really, really young and parents don't want their kids to be the only one without a smartphone because they feel like they'll be socially isolated. They'll be ostracized. Some parents will think that if they don't use technology early, they'll never learn how to use it later, even though it's easier than ever to figure out how to use technology. So there's so many reasons that parents have a hard time. Parents also have a hard time restricting their own technology. I'm one of them. I mean, we're carrying our laptops and our phones everywhere. It's marketing, but it's also weird that it's super ironic. I mean, we make kids wait till they're 16 to drive cars. We make them wait till they're 18 to vote, make them wait till they're 21 to drink. But for some reason we have a hard time making them wait to use technology when arguably there's more dangerous stuff in there than there is in any of the other.
That's what I mean. So. And I think that it's just because they don't know. So we've got to bring this education to the surface. I love that you said 16, 18 and 21. Because you're absolutely right. And of course, you have kids that are older and maybe some younger parents think, oh, well, my fifth grader is so smart and they're not, going to ever get in trouble on anything. But after raising so many, teenagers, you and I know that 16 and 18 and 21 is even too young for those things, right? A 16-year-old driver's license, oh my goodness, when they, you look at any insurance actuary table and you see that is the peak of the highest accident, occurrence that's going to happen at that age. And they can vote at 18, but, can they still remember to wash their face and clean their room? Probably not, so.
Yeah.
Not quite there yet on some of these.
I mean, it definitely comes down to readiness and maybe one of the issues is we just haven't really defined very well what readiness is around technology for kids, and that's, I think I work mostly in the younger space. So for me, it's, I think simpler because I think I make a really strong case that babies don't have any reason to be on technology.
Right.
And again, back to that screen-free till three, I mean, it's so much easier to not give a child technology when they don't know what they're missing than to take it away later. If they're already really into it, then they're going to kick and scream and just be so mad at you if you try to take it away. But if you just don't even put it out there, and then at least you get them a little bit of an anchor. And then, they're going to have plenty of technology later on as they get older. But
you're building a foundation. You're building that strong outdoor foundation, right? Where they're building their brain according to nature, the way it should be. And that's what I love so much about your research. So let's jump over to talking about your research. We've talked about how you kind of came into the issue and how all the stuff about books and reading. And by the way, just want to let everybody know that we will put Dr. Hutton's children's books that you have written in our show notes, because this is a whole nother thing. We are going to be doing a podcast on reading soon. So I may have to bring you back to talk about reading because I'm so passionate about that as well. And I love your story around the children's bookstore and the different things you've developed. So I'm so excited to share that with our audience, but let's dive into, because you've done the research on all that too and reading, but let's dive into the November 2022 research that came out in the article there on screen usage linked to differences in brain structure in young children, because we are really interested in that piece. This is something at Screen Strong. We want to bring the science to parents. They need to understand. So can you break down this study and the findings and just give us the parent version of your research?
Yeah. So we've published, so Cincinnati Children's, you know, I feel very fortunate to, you know, to have worked in an institution. It's big. It's got wonderful people that are really skilled at what they do. And so we've published the only studies to date involving preschool age kids using MRI, which is MRI is basically a big magnet that takes picture of whatever internal structure. Here we're talking about the brain. No radiations involved. Kids that are participating in the research do it all willingly. It's play-based. We don't sedate them. We don't make them sit in the scanner or anything. You know, we actually have them come in and invite them to play the rocket ship game or the statue game. They have to sit really still in the scanner. And we do a couple of main kinds of scans. One is functional scans, which is sort of looking at the brain doing something, whether it's a task like listening to a story or that's the main task we use, or watching something on the screen, or and then we have structural scans, which look at sort of the gray matter of the brain, which is more the cells, and then the white matter of the brain, which is the wires kind of connecting the cells. In any case, so we've done it, quite a few of those. A lot of them are in the reading space, but the screen related ones. The first one we published was in 2021, and it was published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. And it was a group of about 50 kids, preschool age, who the main study was actually a reading based study, but we administered a survey to the parents called the Screen Cue. Which is not just one question around, you know, how much TV does your child watch or anything. It's a composite measure of 15 items that mirrors the current American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines around screen time. So asks like, is there a screen in the child's bedroom? Do they have their own portable device? Do they watch in the car? Do they watch at meals? Do they watch with another person? So what we did is we took the Screen Cue score from these families, and we used it as a predictor in a statistical test, you know, comparing their score on the Screen Cue to the measure of the brain structure. And the first study we published, the JAMA study, was looking again at wiring in the brain. It's called white matter, and it's essentially the fibers that connect the different cells in all over the brain and help them talk to each other. And we found that kids with higher Screen Cue score, which reflected more screen use at home, had lower measures of white matter maturity or development in all over their brain, but specifically in areas that supported reading and literacy. And this reflects a process called myelination. And what myelination is it's sort of the coating around this white matter, these fibers that makes them faster and makes them more efficient. And so kids with higher screen scores had lower measures of this myelination, this white matter development. And it was really the first study to look at that, because there have been all kinds of studies that said, you know, more screens can impact language development, it can impact attention, it can impact all kinds of things. But this was the first one to really take a picture of the brain and show that there were pretty substantial differences in kids with higher screen use at home. And this was a sample, again, of a diverse group of preschoolers. And we controlled for age, sex and household income. So it was a finding that was across families, you know, irrespective of their economic background or whether they're boys or girls or whatever. It was just differences related to screen use. Importantly, with that same study, we also found not only that the brains looked different, but these kids also had lower scores on standardized tests of vocabulary, speed of processing in their brain, how quickly they make decisions related to language, and early literacy.
Wow.
So differences in the brain and also differences in skills. And that study went off like a bomb. I mean, it was all over the place. It was on the New York Times, on the news, everything, because it was really the first one to just could show you a picture and say, yes, these kids' brains are different.
Gosh.
In a not great
that
way.
That is so fascinating. We have been following the ABC study over, you know, the NIH, and they're finding the same thing over there. And they talk a lot about the thickness, right? The cortical thickness. So can you touch on that too? Did y'all come up with any of that on this study?
Yeah. So that was a different study that we published last year.
Okay.
And it's been, it's really the progress of all this MRI research has been just little steps. And this sort of brings up a challenge in science is, as you know well, is that the technology changes so fast, but it takes a while to do scientific studies.
Sure.
And so we've kind of been chopping away at it gradually as we've gone, and we've looked at, again, that first study was white matter.
Okay.
And so this, the second one, the thickness we published last year was, again, a group of around 50 preschool age kids, otherwise healthy, controlling for sex, age, and income. And we found, and this was similar to the ABCD study, we found that kids with more screen use, again, using the screen Q measure, had thinner cortex in their brain, that sort of gray matter surface of the brain where the cells are, in visual areas, which was sort of in the back of the brain. And that paralleled the ABCD findings pretty closely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably related to accelerated maturation of that part of the brain. It was reflecting that kids with more screen use are using that part of the brain a lot. And it's, and I should probably back up a little bit. Cortical thickness is more complicated than the wiring question. Mm-hmm. Like for the most part, the wiring studies are, the myelination are, there's a maximum brain science, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Right.
And so the more you use it, sort of the thicker the white matter gets. And for the most part, it's not exactly linear, but it's a more direct, you know, it's a simpler relationship, you know, using something more gets, you know, the maturation is like thicker myelin, thicker white matter.
Mm-hmm.
In cortical thickness, different parts of the brain mature at different rates. And the brain naturally, over time, the cortex gets thinner in areas that become more efficient, for the most part, developmentally. However, it's at different rates at different parts of the brain. The parts of the brain that support sort of very basic processes like hearing and vision, mm-hmm. Thin early. Like those get thicker when kids are babies, and then they start to thin pretty early in life. The areas that support what are called higher order skills, like language and social skills and math, those get thicker for longer periods of time, and then they start to thin more like in adolescence and, mm-hmm. and later in life. So our findings, so it's not a simple question like thinner is bad or thicker is bad or whatever. It just depends on the age of the child and what part of the brain's involved. Mm-hmm. So here, what we found, and again, these are young kids, is we found thinner cortex in the visual areas, and that's probably reflecting just the visual areas getting more stimulation and maturing more quickly. Don't exactly know what that means, but it parallels the ABCD findings, just that more screen use, probably hyperstimulation of the visual areas and thinning. It's probably a benign finding, but we also found thinner cortex in parts of the brain that are support these higher order skills, specifically social cognition, which is related to empathy. So, and that's a part of the brain that should be getting thicker at that age rather than thinner. And that probably, our finding probably reflects underdevelopment of that part of the brain.
So say that again. That is really important. If y'all, if everybody's who's listening, if you're driving, just pull the car over and listen to this. Explain that one more time, because I think that this is so key for parents to understand this piece.
So essentially what we found is that kids with higher screen use had thinner cortex in parts of the, in two main categories of their brain. One were one was the visual areas. That's probably a natural phenomenon, probably a benign finding.
Right.
That more screens, more stimulation of visual areas, they're probably getting thinner, reflecting more efficient use in that because they're just using them a lot. In visual areas. However, we also found thinner cortex in parts of the brain that support social skills, empathy, called higher order parts of the brain that probably reflects not more efficient, but underdeveloped, because that part of the brain should be getting thicker at that age. And these kids had thinner. Ones with more screen use had thinner cortex as opposed to the kids that had less screen use that were thickening. So that's probably just, again, a lot of those parts of the brain are just related to those early social skills. And it could be just that kids with more screen use in this study just had fewer interactions with their caregivers or other kids or whatever, or pets or the real world or who knows what it is. And it's something that's worth looking at, because to me that, one of the biggest, you hear a lot about a lot of negatives around screen use, whether it's language or obesity or other things. But I think one of the real elephants in the room is just basic human interactions, just relationships, and and we've definitely seen lower empathy levels in like college kids and older kids related to more screen use. Just less practice going out and interacting with other kids. And this could be an early signal that even at that young age, we're starting to see differences in the brain in those parts, in those areas that are supporting those skills later on.
It's fascinating. That is fascinating that this has been pinpointed even on MRI. And I think that parents need to understand that this is not like an opinion. this is a concrete finding that we all need to pay attention to. It reminds me of back in the history of smoking on the first few studies that were coming out to show all the links with cancer, everybody smoked, right? And nobody even knew. We weren't even thinking. All the doctors were smoking too. And then we need these research studies. We are so thankful to have you on and to get to talk to you about this. This is so important because it does really drive the behavior of families. Once they understand some of these things, it's not just like, oh, well, you parent differently and you just have different values. That's not what it is. This is something that is really permanently changing our kids' brains, and our brains are plastic and we can always do better. But there are permanent things that happen, I think, in these foundational years. And we're just seeing now from, the experiment, what it looks like on these MRIs. I'm so fascinated with this. So what do these findings really mean for families? How would you interpret this for families?
I think, to me, it just highlights the idea that we just need to be careful. I mean, it's, I know you work with the Children and Screens group, but, one of the doctors that works with that group, in an article years ago, put out the idea that, we're conducting this great uncontrolled experiment in our society where kids are being given technology younger and younger, and we're sort of fundamentally changing how they're growing up in the world, and expecting nothing bad to happen, or expecting only good things to happen. And it just, I think a lot of these studies are just showing that, and again, mine are all with younger kids, that we just need to be, we just need to be careful. And the view in America has always been, we need to prove that something's harmful before we take it away. And the view in a lot of countries in Europe, by contrast, and not all of them, is more like we have to prove that this isn't harmful for kids before we let them have it.
Touche. Yeah.
Yeah. I think until we really know what we're dealing with, especially when kids are young and their brains are growing really quickly and they're really, really, really dependent on constructive, healthy experiences, mm-hmm. we just need to be careful and maybe just, you know, like, again, as you were saying earlier, you know, keep them anchored in the real world and not hand them something that potentially could be a big problem.
Yeah. And know that it's okay to pause and to skip, you know, these highly stimulating, addictive, dopamine producing screens during the young years, which include the teenage years. Why would we risk that? Why? Well, you know, you look at the risk and benefits, right? You have to constantly look at that. And the risk and benefits really don't, they're not even, they don't weigh out well for this issue. And I know for one, I have just finished, you know, with the boys, we have two high school boys that just graduated and they did just fine. They did just fine without a smartphone. They did just fine without video games. There are no risk. There are a lot of benefits. Now, you know, you can create some risk in your head. You can say, well, they didn't, you know, have a social media account and they needed to have more friends. And I would come right back and say, no, that's not a risk. In fact, that's a benefit that they were able to do that. And the more I hear you talk, the more I'm so thankful that we really allowed them to develop that part of their brain really well when they were young. It's sort of like developing a baseball player. You want them to learn how to hold the bat the right way when they're young, not have to unlearn it when, you know, they hit college age. And that's what I think that we just want to err on the side of caution when it comes to this issue. And these studies that you're doing and that you're a part of are the underlining reason why, because it is very serious. I see this as a very serious issue and these findings are very serious. And in the article here that we will put in the show notes for those of y'all that want to read more about it, we'll put the study and the articles in here. But you have a quote in here that says the consistency of these brain findings involving young children and those involving teens suggests there may be a cumulative impact of digital media use, which tends to increase with age. I want you to talk about that just for a second before we have to go, because I'm a firm believer in this idea of the accumulation of screen time and the cumulative effect, because I think there's a misunderstanding by parents that feel like, well, it's kind of one and done, you know, I'm having a bad day or it's raining, so I'm just going to let them play today, or I'm just going to let them do the, and I don't think they understand the cumulative effect the way I understood it in a real life world with my oldest son. I can tell you there's a cumulative effect. Can you explain the science behind my intuition around that?
Yeah. Well, I think broadly it's just that it's back to that sort of, you know, what neurons that fire together, wire together thing, you know, really anything that a child is doing, their brain is going to reinforce the neural circuits involved with that. And so I'll often hear from parents, you know, like I want my child to be a better reader. You know, what do I do? And it's like, well, they should read. You know, I want my child to be a better baseball player. They should practice baseball.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and a lot of the stuff's like, well, can I make my child a better reader by having them watch these videos about reading? And it's like, you know, or some, but so it's like kids that are, if you want, kids that play video games a lot are going to be better at playing video games. Kids that watch social media are going to be better at watching social media. They're not going to be better at having, you know,
love that.
Playing a sport or an instrument or whatever. They just have to, I mean, it's really kind of, I mean, it sounds overly simplistic, but it's kind of true. I mean, if you want your child to be a good piano player, they have to practice piano.
Yeah.
In any case. So, and this stuff does, it adds up. I mean, you know, kids are on their devices. I mean, back in the day, I mean, there was a TV in the living room and it was there and you watched TV, but when you weren't in the living room, you didn't have a choice. You couldn't watch TV anymore. Now the devices follow kids around and they could literally watch anything, do anything, access any content anywhere, anytime.
Right.
Except God forbid when they don't have Wi-Fi in the country and then they freak out. But like, but in any case, it's just, the technology's gotten so good that what you said, that one and done, you know, you hand the child the phone at the grocery store and they're off to the races, and they're going to want more of that because they're going to get those little dopamine bursts, and they're going to be like, "Can I just try it one more time, one more time?" And again, it's, you know, kids are different. Some kids, you know, you hand them a phone one time, it's probably like alcohol or something. It's like, you know, kid A doesn't have a predisposition to alcoholism, and they drink alcohol and they don't like it and never want to touch it again. Kid B drinks it and they're like, "This is great. I want more of that." And they're going to be, you know, and they have to be old enough to handle it.
But I believe even the kid A, I think you can, with enough screen time, enough alcohol, and enough of the illegal drugs and all the things that produce dopamine, I believe that you can move them down that path, you know, maybe when they weren't predisposed to do that. I think that's kind of an interesting discussion that we have. We'll have another day, but I've always kind of been lighthearted about it when I say, give me a 10-year-old and I can turn them into a gamer in a week. You know, into an addicted gamer in a week, because the platforms are so powerful, and those platforms, I think, override some of the predispositions. But that, I don't have a study that says that. I just have a feeling that with enough time on a dopamine producing activity, that we can become very accustomed to it, even if we don't like it, right? Because a lot of people that are addicts, they don't even like the thing that they're doing, but they just keep doing it because their brain is driven to do it. So this is so fascinating. I am so fascinated with your research and with your life work on this, all the way from the reading and the childhood reading through these studies. You have a really interesting life. I'm just going to say, you may not know.
I appreciate that. That's one way to put it.
No, it's really fascinating. Oh my gosh, to be able to be involved in these studies and actually see just cutting edge and firsthand and boots in the ground here in the medical community to see exactly what's happening. You get sort of a bird's eye view into what's happening in these brains. And then you can work with us, and we can somehow package all this for parents to understand so they can take a different pathway and not be so riddled with these problems. Just as we close, that our time is so flown by as it always does, but as we close, can you talk a minute and just give some encouragement to parents who, gosh, they're really struggling, you know, maybe they've got their teens all on social media or on video games, and they come to Screen Strong and they're now saying, "Oh my gosh, what do? I've got to make a change." And though they start to go through our detox, they start detoxing their kids, but it is so discouraging, especially when our kids are a little bit older. You know, it's easy to do, Dr. Hutton, when they're, you know, 3 or 4 years old, but when they hit 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, boy, it's hard. So just in a second, can you just talk to that? Is it possible to actually raise kids without smartphones and video games and these toxic screens? And then can you talk about, or just give us some encouragement? Because we've heard some kind of bad news today. And so let's talk about some encouraging things. So first of all, is it possible? And then what encouraging words can you offer for parents that are choosing to take a different path?
It's absolutely possible. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the iPhone was just invented about 20 years ago, maybe if that. And so, you know, really, it's been such a blink in the eye of human evolution that all these media have been out there. So, you know, it's absolutely possible to raise kids that are healthy and vibrant without any of this. If you think about it, the people that invented Google, for example, and Apple didn't grow up with technology.
Right.
I mean, they're too old. I mean, Steve Jobs didn't have an iPad. You know, he grew up and just was a normal kid, whatever. And then he went on to invent Apple computers. So
he was a big reader too.
Technology.
Big reader.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, and you hear about that a lot too. A lot of these Silicon Valley executives, you know, are sending their kids to Montessori schools and Waldorf schools, and, you know, keeping them away from technology. So they're kind of, you get a sense that this may not be super healthy for their own children. Mm-hmm. But in any case, so it's definitely possible. I think one of the keys, I've come to believe that a restrictive tone is not as effective as an encouraging tone.
Right.
So not so much don't use your technology, but at some point kids need to be inspired to have something else that gets them excited.
Right.
You know, and so it's like there is world beyond your phone, you know, whether that's a pet, you know, like getting a puppy, mm-hmm. You know, an instrument, art, you know, a sport, you know, whatever it is, something that they can put them, immerse themselves in, mm-hmm. that's not screen related, that's going to make them feel good about themselves, that they have control over.
Yes.
And one of the things I really love about, you know, Screen Strong's curriculum is just, you know, you're doing that through providing all kinds of alternative activities that are yes. not, you know, it's not so much screens are bad, you're bad, you know, I'm going to punish you. It's this, look at all this other stuff out in the world that's going to get you excited and try these things.
Yes.
And because my daughter is one of those kids. I mean, she is super anxious. She knows it. She's on social media all the time. I tell her about it and she says, I know, Dad, it drives me crazy, but I don't have a choice. And she feels like almost like you said earlier, in that screen prison, trapped. And on those days when I can somehow pry her away from that and get her to do something else, she'll be so energized. And at some point, just what I hope for her is that she'll realize that just those breaks from technology are so, are so rejuvenating, that, you know,
and I
hear that a little bit, that kids are migrating more to like flip phones and wanting to kind of get away from some of these sort of high powered devices. And I hope that's where things go. Cause if I were to pick two developmental stages to really be more mindful of, is that 0 to 5, when the brain's growing really fast, learning really basic things, really foundational things. And then again, in adolescence, mm-hmm. when puberty happens and the brain's growing super fast and it's all about social. And that's when I think we need to be most mindful of technology in childhood. And, you know, if possible, to get it away. But
you are so screen strong. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you. I mean, the last thing I would say is I do hear from parents, is it too late? You know, like have I damaged my child? My child's just, oh my gosh, I've been such a bad parent. And parents need to give themselves a break a little bit because it is hard.
Yeah.
We're in an era where there's so much out there, so much confusion, so much anxiety around all these technologies. Do we need them? Do we not need them? Are they good? Are they bad? Parents just need to realize that they're their child's best teacher. That it's never too late. They can go back and make small changes.
Yep.
And just be, you know, just try to dial things back to encourage non-screen activities and just engage with our kids. And I mean, it's never too late. The brain is plastic.
Yeah.
You can rewire and, you know, if possible, you know, you want to prevent things, but if the child's struggling, just to really, you know, it's never too late. And,
Thank you. That is so encouraging. We needed to hear that. And I'm here to tell you too, it's never too late. Either. It's never too late. We have to, you know, Dr. Stacy says all the time, we have to do better when we know better. And after today, thanks to you, Dr. Hutton, you have helped us know better. Thank you. So if anyone was out there kind of struggling, you know, hit replay, listen to this again, share this with your spouse and your friends and even your kids. I think it's fine to share the science with them. So thank you so much for joining us
for
sharing all of your stuff with us. And we are going to become good friends, by the way, in case you're wondering.
Hope so.
We're going to have you help us a little more over here at Screen Strong and with the parents that are following us. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melanie. It's been a pleasure.
So thank you all for listening today. If you have any questions, please email me at team@screenstrong.org. And what is your homework? Share this podcast with your friends. Share this with your community, with your tribe, with your village, because the more community we have around delaying and pausing and skipping, the better we do. Also, I want to remind everybody to get over on our website and sign up on our website to get a little newsletter we send out a couple times a month, as well as you will be getting the information on the actual lifestyle course that we have and the course we're doing for kids. So, and we're going to try to get other physicians like Dr. Hutton to get in there and review everything and make sure all the science is just perfect so your kids can learn all about this too. Remember, we've got your back, and we are here to be your GPS and help you detour around the screen wrecks ahead. So until next time, stand up for your kids, stand out from the crowd, and stay strong.